everyone. This is Sam Black with Drafting Archetypes, and today I'm going to be discussing Bant in MKM Draft. As always, the notes are available to follow along at patreon.com/draftingarchetypes. Before I get into it, I want to note that I almost called this Bant Detectives and then decided not to because I thought it would be misleading. While you can have detective synergies in Bant, and a lot of the creatures that you want to play happen to be detectives, I don't think it's important to the archetype, and I think that a lot of versions of Bant decks won't use detectives, or won't use, well, they'll almost all have detectives in the deck, but they won't use any explicit detective synergies. And in a lot of ways, I think that Bant feels like a specifically low synergy deck, and so having a title that implied any particular synergistic direction seemed off. So that's kind of where my head's at on the structure of this archetype. I don't put a lot of stock in the win rates on 17 lands, especially for non-two-color decks, because I feel like there are just a lot of different things they can be, and a lot of the success of multicolor decks comes down to stuff like making sure that your mana works, and a lot of the reason that people draft multiple color decks is that the seat that they were in for a two color deck, like that two color pair wasn't open, so they're kind of making the best of a bad situation. So I don't think that it's like really fair to compare three color decks to like two color decks, for example. But notably, Bant is the best performing of the three color decks with a worse win rate than decks that are any two of the colors in Bant, but an above average win rate. Structurally, because Bant isn't a two color deck, I think you're never looking to be very aggressive. You can definitely make tempo plays, and there will be games where you're the aggressor, but just in general, you should expect that if you're playing a three-color deck, that most of the time your opponent is playing a two-color deck, unless they're like a dedicated control deck, they're probably going to be the aggressor more of the time, and so you want to be in a position to play a defensive game. All of the gold uncommons available to Bant are good cards that you would want to put in basically any Bant deck. That's in green-white, the Sumala Sentry, the 1-3 reach that gets bigger and makes your morphs bigger when you flip things over. Buried in a Garden, green-white, 2 enchantment that makes your enchanted land tap for an additional mana of any color and exiles a thing when it enters. Evidence Examiner, the blue-green 2-2 that can collect evidence 4 to make a clue at the beginning of combat and also makes a clue whenever you collect evidence. Repulsive Mutation, the blue-green X counterspell that also puts X counters on something. Private Eye, the 3-3 Detective Lord, and also No More Lies, the blue-white instant that counters something unless they pay 3 and then exiles it. Those are all cards that you're happy to put in basically any deck that's these colors. So there's a lot of strength at uncommon available in this space. There are also, of course, a lot of good rares. I think Bant decks generally want to play not very many commons. Kind of true of anything if you can, you know, make it go that way. But I guess particularly true when, you know, you're really looking to maximize all those gold uncommons and stuff. Because this is only a three-color deck and because one of the colors is green, I think it's pretty realistic to be just like solid three rather than two and a splash or one and two splashes or whatever. But to make that happen, you do need to prioritize fixing. I talk a lot about like have enough fixing or prioritize fixing or whatever without really getting into exactly what that means. And I think when talking about like a solid three-color deck in this format, I can do a little bit better. I can be a little more precise. I think you're looking to have 8 to 9 cards that can give you mana of each of your colors. So like that's saying, you know, treat Escape Tunnel as a tri-land for these purposes. Treat Topiary Panther as a tri-land also. But it's a tri-land that requires green, so I basically treat it as a green-white dual land. So if you think of this as wanting nine sources of each color, again, you could probably actually get away with eight. But if you think of it as wanting nine, then you're looking for 27 total colored mana sources. So like in a normal 17 land with all basic lands and no fixing, you have 17 total colored mana sources. If you're playing a three-color deck and you replace one of those basic lands with an escape tunnel, that's basically plus two. You're turning a land that could only give you one color into a land that could give you any of the three colors. So you've moved from 17 colored sources to 19 colored sources just by having the functional tri-land in your deck. So if you're trying to get to nine of each, but say maybe eight of one would be acceptable, then you're trying to get to 26, 27, could, you know, if you only had 24, your deck wouldn't be a complete failure, but it would be better to have more. So you're looking to get from 17 to 26 or 27. So you need to find plus 10 total in your fixing. So Nervous Gardeners, Topiary Panthers, they went this ways. Those are all plus two because you need the green, so you can't really count it as a green source most of the time. And Gravestone Strider, the 1/3 that can filter colors, is plus three. Any other colorless things that you play that can give you any other colors that don't replace a land are plus three. If they do replace a land, they're plus two. Any of the Surveil lands are plus one. If you end up a little light, you can certainly take card selection and card draw into account. So stuff like Maverick, whatever it's called, the one mana Surveil 2/1/1, and Deduce and stuff like that, they all make things a little bit more forgiving. But roughly, these are the cards that you should be counting, and these are the numbers you should be targeting. So what that means is that you're probably looking for about five pieces of fixing, give or take, because the fixing that you play is going to average plus two per card. So when you're drafting what you know is going to be a balanced three-color deck, you can have a target of five pieces of fixing in mind. And so you can know that, like, if you're in the middle of pack two and you have three pieces of fixing, you're in a pretty good place. Whereas if you have like two pieces of fixing, you probably need to increase how highly you're prioritizing your fixing. All of this is, you know, a bit flexible. Not all fixing is created equal, and there's a decent chance that you'll be splashing another color, and exactly how good your mana is going to need to be at the end depends on, you know, things that you won't know during the draft. And so drafting a few more than five and having options about which one you play and, you know, taking some precautions, maybe taking a They Went This Way in a spot where you hope not to need it, but if you do need it, it's there for you, is definitely something to, you know, keep in mind and do while you're drafting. But I've noticed that I, like, feel like I have a pretty good sense of what I need when I'm drafting multicolored decks, and I haven't adequately conveyed that to other people. And this is the best I can do at giving more concrete numbers and examples about how to think about and how to prioritize that stuff. So this applies to, you know, any like balanced three-color deck. But again, in this format and when green's there, I think you can afford to be on the very good end of mana in this space. So that's what I would advise as far as making your mana work here. It's still very important to have a good curve. You know, regardless of whether you're attacking or blocking, you don't want to fall too far behind. You want to have two drops. You want to have one drop where possible. You want to keep pace with your opponent even when you're not looking to end the game. But as with other multicolor decks, you would prefer for your cheap creatures to be creatures that block well, or creatures that, you know, serve multiple purposes. Gravestone Striders and Nervous Gardeners being able to function as fixing and as two drops is very good. You know, I think that it's important to... It's best with Nervous Gardeners if you can actually play them as 2/2s for two sometimes. So don't like ignore that mode and think of them only as creatures that you like have to play face down. So because you're unlikely to get like five lands that improve your mana, you're probably going to be using some of your spell slots for fixing. Those won't necessarily strictly be mana, like Gravestone Strider and Nervous Gardener and even Topiary Panther are also cards that you can cast as, you know, creatures that impact the game. But it does mean that, like, some of the power, you're taking some power from your spells as spells and putting it into mana, and that just makes you a little bit more likely to flood out. I've had some problems recently in some of my multicolor decks where I just like flood out very badly in some portion of my games. And I think it's important to look to prioritize ways to mitigate this. That could be stuff like Projector Inspector or Evidence Examiner are good ways to like filter cards or draw more cards. Projector Inspector is the 3/2 that loots when it or another detective enters the battlefield or turns face up. Evidence Examiner, again, is the 2/2 that makes clues. Also, just, you know, really prioritizing having a high power level, a lot of 2-for-1s can help make up for the fact that, like, you might be a little bit mana heavy. Something else that I noticed in looking at stats on cards, just in general, and in Bant decks specifically on 17 lands, there are some cards that have performed pretty well that I personally have been possibly incorrectly avoiding. Reasonable Doubt, the 2-mana counterspell, unless your opponent pays 2, that suspects something, and Unauthorized Exit, the 2-mana bounce spell that surveils, perform well. So cheap interactive blue spells. I tried some cheap interactive blue spells in blue tempo decks where I was also playing cheap creatures, and those decks felt extremely underpowered. I think that was more of an issue with the blue creatures than with the blue spells. I think the blue spells, it makes sense to like complement impactful morphs with cheap tempo plays. You just need to make sure that, you know, you're not like bounce spells and Crime Stopper sprites and none of your cards do anything. So also cards that have overperformed are Hotshot Investigators, the 6-mana 4/4 that bounces something, and if it was your thing, you investigate. And Vengeful Creeper, the 5/5 morph that destroys an artifact or enchantment when you turn it face up. Those are cards that I kind of like, but I've been assuming, like, they've been ending up just outside of rather than just inside of my decks more often than not due to, like, trying to have a low curve and stuff. I've had good experiences when I've played those cards and pairing those kind of like high impact late game creatures with the cheap tempo spells to get there definitely makes sense. So I think I want to try kind of trusting some of what 17 lands is suggesting there, prioritizing some of those cheap blue interactive spells a little bit more and pairing them with some of the more impactful common creatures. Like the cheap spells help you like double spell and not fall behind. And then, you know, Vengeful Creeper answers a lot of like pretty important, uncommon, especially bombs like Buried in the Garden and Coerced to Kill. Having a clean answer to those is just so huge because your opponent's usually like really counting on those to do a lot for them. I'm also very into Out Cold, the 4-mana instant that taps 2 things and is uncounterable and stuns them and investigates. Interestingly, that one has kind of mediocre stats on 17 lands, although it becomes like the second best blue common among top players. It's somewhat speculative for me. I have, because I was like a little bit lower on it early. And then I realized like when I'm trying to play a longer game, The clue is just so valuable in terms of like changing how that card works. A lot of the time, those like that kind of card, I guess Frost Breath was the original. Frost Breath's like they can be, you know, really big tempo swings in games where that matters, but sometimes it doesn't and you end up down a card. But when you're not down a card and you just, like, buy a lot of time in exchange for mana, it's pretty easy for, like, buying time in combat in exchange for mana to be profitable for you one way or another. I think that, like, I should be thinking about this more like, you know, the, like, one in a blue, tap a creature, scry one, like, that kind of effect. Scry one, draw a card, which I liked in Lord of the Rings and didn't like in Wilds of Eldraine. But, like, that kind of thing where you're just kind of treading water in terms of card advantage, but slowing your opponent down on the board. I have a lot of, you know, interest in that kind of card. I still might not prioritize Out Cold super highly, though, just because I think that Bant wants to be pretty high creature. And there are a lot of non-creature spells that I think are comparably good. Like, you only want so much total of Reasonable Doubt, Unauthorized Exit, Makeshift Binding, Bite Down on Crime. There's a lot, like, there are just a bunch of, like, good spells in this space. And I think a lot of them go pretty late. I mean, I think it's just the case in general in this format that removal goes later on average in this format than it has in basically any other. And so you get kind of as much of that stuff as you want if you prioritize it a little bit more than other people. And I think you only want, like, 3 to 6 total of those cards. So I don't think you need to, like, highly prioritize any of them. And I think whatever mix you end up with is kind of okay. So I mentioned that I think that this is, like, a pretty low synergy deck. I think that you want it to, like, look, feel, and play almost more like a sealed deck than like a draft deck, where you want just independently high impact cards, as many high rarity cards as possible, support with some removal and some, like, high impact, like, 2-for-1, like, commons that are capable of 2-for-1-ing, which describes a lot of the morphs, or disguise creatures, as well as, you know, even stuff like Novice Inspector and Inside Source. It's hard to call those a straight 2-for-1, but there are a decent number of X1s in the format. And so the 1-2 or 1-1 body that you're getting in addition to your 2-2 or your Clue, like, those do have the ability to actually trade for a card some portion of the time. There are a lot of commons that, you know, have ways of getting you ahead on cards. And you don't need all of your commons to be that. Like, you do just want, you know, some cheap plays and, like I said, some interactive spells. But just generally having, like, a sealed deck mindset where you just expect that cards are going to trade off and you kind of want to have the last highest impact thing standing, and you're kind of positioning yourself to take advantage of rares and gold cards and really playing just, like, a mid-range game where you're not exactly, like, an aggro deck, you're not exactly a control deck. Tempo matters. Sometimes you're going to be attacking, sometimes you're going to be blocking. Really just kind of flexible, versatile cards is kind of how I'm imagining most of these Bant decks coming together. So there are, you know, that's pretty different than, like, the 5-color decks where I'm basically just like, yeah, it's going to take some time for my mana to come together, and I'm expecting that my spells are just going to be stronger than my opponent's. I don't think that that's the case with the Bant decks. I think that, you know, you're getting some amount of consistency in exchange for some amount of power. You're going to see a few, like, really powerful cards in the draft that you just, like, pass because they're out of your colors. So you're going to want to be able to, like, play a few more of these tempo spells to, like, have a plan to end the game against kind of the, like, other multicolor decks with more power than you. I think the other thing that I would want to pay attention to is having an actual plan to end the game, which isn't something that I, like, think about or talk about very often, right? Because, like, either you're an aggressive deck and your plan is obvious. It's just, I'm going to attack and I'm going to get my opponent's life total to 0 before they're able to use all their cards. My plan to end the game is, like, I have a curve and some combat tricks or whatever. Or you're a control deck and your plan to end the game is, I'm going to stay alive, my cards are going to be more powerful than my opponents, and I'm going to win with them. Like, I have a command in my chat in Twitch that is !WinCon, and it basically just describes a normal game of Magic, right? Like, you just get ahead and, like, the game ends in your favor. Yeah, accrue value, put power and toughness into play, attack opponent for lethal is what comes up when you hit WinCon. Sometimes people will look at a deck that has 16 creatures in it and they'll be like, what's your WinCon? And the answer is these 16 creatures. Like, some of them are going to not die and then they're going to attack and the game's going to end. But with these Bant decks, I feel like it's nice to have either some kind of, like, over-the-top rare you can count on to win a game, like Ezrim, the blue-blue-white-white one Sphinx, or Doppelgang, the blue-green X spell that makes copies of things. Some kind of card that is going to beat most cards your opponent's going to play collectively. Or you could have a plan where you're like, you know, I'm going to go a little bit wide. I'm going to generate a stalled board. I'm going to have a couple of things that make more than one body. And then I'm going to have, you know, a few Greenbelt Radical or on-the-job type cards. And at some point, that's probably going to lead to a spot where, like, I can make an attack, do my pump thing, and win the game. Or, you know, maybe you have, like, a few Private Eyes and a few, like, sources of clues or other card draw, and you're like, if we get into a stall, I'm going to be able to beat them with unblockable creatures. Or maybe you have an above average number of flyers and a few removal spells to answer your opponents, like reach creatures and flyers that can block your flyers, and you're like, I'm going to win in the air. But, you know, your low synergy, like, pile of mid-sized bodies, it's good to have, like, a vague idea of why, like, what's going to happen to lead to you winning a game where you and your opponent are playing similar kinds of cards. So it's not so much like, oh, this one card is my win con, so much as it is, I do have a plan for, like, what the game looks like when I win. And there's a lot of room for different answers to that question, but it's good to have, you know, a script to close the game out in mind while you're drafting and while you're playing and building your deck and, you know, at all points. Like, this is what I'm working toward. Maybe I'm stalling for my thing. Maybe I'm trying to get damage in so that I can close it out with a trick. Just some kind of coherent plan. And again, Bant can be a lot of different things. You're in the mid-range space. You can certainly be different mixes of your different colors. So the plans could be, There are a lot of applicable plans, but you should be able to, you should know it's going to go this way when in the games that are, like, close and grindy. And that's kind of what I have to say about Bant. I don't think it, like, revolves around particular standout commons. I think that, you know, all of the commons are kind of role players and hole fillers and curve fillers, and, you know, it's really going to be the uncommons and rares that are, like, what the deck is about, what you're here for, what your games revolve around. So it's really not like you're looking for this, like, interaction that exists at common or something like that. Make your mana work, have a plan, have, you know, high impact stuff and good interaction. And if you have played a good amount of Sealed and Draft and have, like, a decent handle on the difference in how those formats play, I think thinking of it in the Sealed space could be helpful. And that's it. So I'm going to turn it over to chat for any kind of question or discussion about this. And I do want to thank the newest patron of Drafting Archetypes, Zach. Thank you very much for the support. If anyone else is interested in joining the Patreon, getting your own shout out and other benefits and supporting the show, of course, check out patreon.com/draftingarchetypes. How do you get into this deck as opposed to just two of the three colors? You know, have a good card that's two of the colors and then have a pack where you get rewarded for adding the third color. you know, it's very often going to be you are two of the colors, and then it's like sixth pick, pack one, and you get past a gold card that is one of your colors and the third color. And you're like, yeah, you know, that adds a lot of power to my deck. And like, I'd rather have that than some sixth pick common. And so you take it and you try to stretch your deck a little. Because all six of the gold uncommons are cards that you would like actively want to find a way to get in your deck, some more splashable than others, of course, that's a pretty common path for me, right? So like, I'd be drafting maybe like white blue and I get past a repulsive mutation and I'm like, okay, that would make my deck a decent amount better. Let's take that and see if it makes sense to expand into green and then figure out if I'm like just splashing that or if I'm pivoting one of my other colors into a splash or if I'm solid three. I can figure that out later, but I know that I'd like to have access to this powerful card that I saw kind of late. The other option, of course, is you get some like really good bomb in a color that's not open, and then you like draft two other colors and splash the bomb. I'd say those are like the most normal ways for it to happen, but there are, you know, a lot of possible ways to find yourself in the space. How hard is it to include some of the double pips in an off color, thinking about stuff like Ezreum? It is meaningfully harder to support double pip cards than single pip cards, especially if most of your fixing is stuff like Escape Tunnel. The more of your fixing is stuff is like more solid. Like, for example, when I was talking about like the counts, I didn't mention Buried in the Garden. Buried in the Garden, because it requires both green and white mana, I mostly think of it as a blue source. But it's a very, like, it's a blue source that also helps you get double green or double white without, and it's not even a choice, right? It's like hard all three once it's in play. And like Public Thoroughfare is also, you know, harder fixing than Escape Tunnel. And the more thoroughfares relative to Escape Tunnels you have, the better you're going to be able to deal with double pips. Similarly, I don't typically count the untapper guy that can collect evidence to tap things as mana fixing. But if you have a lot of doubles, then it does fix for your doubles. So when you have a lot of doubles, I don't even know if I would really say it changes your counts from like, oh, you need 9 to you need 10. Really, it's you need 9 and 7 or 8 is less safe than it would be otherwise, where sometimes you can get by with 7 or 8. But more to the point, the more doubles you have, the more hard fixing rather than soft fixing you need. So the more you need your like Gravestone Striders and your Surveil Lands and your Public Thoroughfares, and the less you can get by with your Nervous Gardeners, and unless you have a Surveil Land to find or Escape Tunnels or whatever. I saw discussion earlier about whether Nervous Gardener counts as +3 rather than +2 if you have a Surveil Land. And the answer is no, because it's never your first green source. But it counts as harder fixing if you have a Surveil Land than if you don't. And the, like, how to weigh hard fixing against soft fixing, I don't have a great numerical way to discuss worked out yet, but it's definitely something that I think about, particularly when I'm trying to support doubles. I'm still in a vibes space on that. I might try to develop it into something that can be expressed a little bit better later on. Broadly, the answer is double pips are hard but workable. Ezreum is worth working for. Is this kind of a mindset you can get into with any of the green, white, plus the third color? Yeah, absolutely. The discussion about how to make mana work is very much, you know, plays in any color combination and also across formats. You won't always necessarily be able to expect like 9 of each source, and in formats with fewer colored mana symbols on the cards, the number that you need is lower. And again, really, you can often get by with 7 or 8 instead of 9, right? Like a 2-color deck with no fixing is going to be 9, 8, and like the 8's totally acceptable. The reason that I've gone harder, like up to a higher number, is because of the expectation that a lot of it's soft. And so there's some fear about how you count it. So I figure like 9 is a safe target. But again, if you're on like 7 or 8s, like it certainly can work. White has really good common creatures. Green provides fixing. And the third color provides some board interaction. That's a reasonable way to think about it. Although like green and white do also give you some interaction in this set. Is the blue providing something unique? No, not really. Like certainly like the fact that all of the uncommons in this group are good means that it's like a little bit better than if some of the uncommons were not as good. And, you know, like I mentioned that this color combination performs well, but like the mindset about like fixing and game plan and stuff can certainly work for, you know, any three color, especially any three color green deck. If the mindset for sealed is to expect one for ones and expect trades, what's the general mindset for draft? So the primary difference between sealed and draft is that there are more rares in sealed. Because there are more rares, removal is a little bit more important because you have to be able to answer the rares. Also, you have access to more removal in sealed than you do in draft in formats where players would be prioritizing removal highly. Like if you assume that like every removal spell is getting taken by pick 3, then, or at least every good removal spell, then the fact that you get to see more total packs doesn't help as much as just opening more packs yourself does. So you have like more access to like rares and removal in sealed, but you have less access to depth of color, because in draft you can find an open lane and get like your, you know, above average cards of that color every pick in the draft, and have more focus, more synergy, that more cards of a single color, more general choice about your less universally desirable cards. So draft is high synergy, sealed is bombier. The fact of sealed being bombier means you prioritize more of the removal that you have more access to. And then the abundance of removal is why sealed ends up being a space where you expect one for ones. But the fact that it's bombier and everyone's playing more of the best cards means you should also expect more two for ones. But in general, you should expect that things are dying more and the games are a little bit smaller. And it's more important for each card to carry its own weight and be able to win on its own after everything is traded off in sealed than in draft. But also expect that like more of the games are going to revolve around a rare in sealed than draft. So it's kind of like low. So that's kind of what I'm talking about with the like low synergy. You want, you know, cards that can just kind of stand, win a game on their own, being like what I'm thinking about in this space, in this archetype, and how that relates to sealed versus draft. With new boosters providing more rares and even duplicates, is the line between sealed and draft blurring a little now? Possibly. There are more rares, so more games are going to like revolve around those. Synergy is still, you know, important in draft. So I don't know. Maybe they're closer. They're still different. And it's also different format to format. So it's like hard to compare. How smoothly does this deck interpolate into other decks? For example, Gravestone Strider is a key card in Chalk Outline / Insidious Roots. Is drafting a deck between those two viable? Yeah, I mean, so of course you're in the blue-green space where like some portion of these decks are going to care about collect evidence and some aren't. And when your deck does care about collect evidence and does have some of those active in the graveyard cards and does have some like looting or self-mill, which is available in blue and green, then like you can use Chalk Outline or Splash Insidious Roots. I think it's more likely that your Bant decks are going to want to just like play Chalk Outline than Splash Insidious Roots. Chalk Outline, I think, is like a bunch of like collect evidence, and Chalk Outline is kind of a reasonable answer to how am I going to deal with like flooding out? What's my like late game plan? How am I going to win these late games? So there is room for those cards. There is space to pivot in that direction. I don't think white offers a lot to the like Chalk Outline Insidious Roots decks, though my first draft in the Arena Open earlier this week, I did draft an Abzan Roots deck. I first picked Aurelia's Vindicator, the best mythic in the set, which the 4/2 that exiles stuff from play and from graveyards. That happens to have a little bit of synergy with Insidious Roots, I suppose. And that deck was pretty good, but certainly an outlier deck. And it was mostly good just because it had a lot of really good rares, more than because of the Insidious Roots thing that it was doing. So there is, you know, with any of the build arounds in this format, I think there's room to incorporate them in, like, weird decks or to, like, splash for a package that includes them, rather than only playing them in, like, the most normal case for them. Like, I could imagine a Bant deck that has, like, a good amount of clues, which you can get from all of your colors, and is, like, splashing two Detective Satchels, and that's, like, a core part of its plan. Similarly to how, you know, Chalk Outline could be a core part of the plan. So, just the nature of, you know, Bant as a, like, kind of a little bit slower or, like, mid-range deck gives it space to lean into some of the, like, late game payoff build around type stuff, whatever stuff that ends up being. I noticed a comment earlier that Pick Your Poison is extremely underrated. This is an interesting one to me. Pick Your Poison is the green sorcery, choose one, each opponent sacrifices an artifact, enchantment, or creature with flying. I've seen a few people say that they think this card's very underrated and they've had good results with playing it main. I've also seen a few people say that they've tried playing it and it's been very bad for them. It's easy for me to see either of those happening, and I think this is a case where any individual sample size is just going to be too small. So I have erred toward trusting the 17 lands data on this, and with any sort I can find, looking at, you know, players of different skill levels, different archetypes, anything I've seen, I haven't checked every possible sort, but everything I've seen, Pick Your Poison has seemed to perform pretty poorly. So while I'm not sure that it's a card you should never play, like if you have a deck that needs some kind of, you know, cheap interactive card that might, like, let you pick up some tempo or whatever, or if you're particularly weak against flyers, I could see playing it. I think that it is not really underrated or a card that you should generally be main decking in most decks. Not super high confidence in that, because again, I know that there are people who have, like, played it and have good experiences with it, and I have less personal information than they do. But it does seem like the kind of thing where, you know, any individual sample size with it's not going to be huge and it's easy to be colored by a few games where it saved you or a few games where it rotted in your hand. Anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. Next week, I, of course, am going to be back with another archetype. I think at a place where I'm looking to put more effort into exploring aggressive archetypes. So I hope to be able to talk about a few different aggressive archetypes in the next few weeks. I certainly have been, you know, giving the impression, if the only information you have about this format is my podcast, that there are just different multicolor decks, and that's certainly not the case. They're, you know, the two-color aggressive decks in this format, I think, are both strong and varied. And I've reached the point where I've explored the multicolor decks enough that I feel like I have a pretty good handle on how they work. And I'm getting curious about and interested in going a little bit out of my way to draft the more aggressive decks, just as, like, a change of pace for myself. So looking forward to covering a number of those moving forward. So that's where I hope to be for next week. So that's all for now. Thanks for listening, and I will be back next week. Have a good week. Bye. Prepare for light speed.